Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. And for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. The U.S. Treasury officially labels China a currency manipulator. The Trump administration has officially labeled China a currency manipulator after the Chinese central bank allowed the renminbi to fall below a key threshold, marking a dramatic escalation in the trade war between the two economic powers. This while Trump plays down fallout from China trade war. Donald Trump has dismissed concerns about the trade war with China, while his top economic aide said the U.S. president was committed to negotiations with Beijing after labeling the country a currency manipulator. Well, my first guest told us last week that we were on a rocky road from a trade war to an economic war, and I think he's right. He's the professor of economics at St. Mary's College of California and author of Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy and the Coming Depression, Dr. Jack Rasmus. Jack, as always, welcome back.
Always glad to be back.
We're also joined by Associate Professor of Economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, Dr. Linwood Taheed. Linwood, welcome back.
Thank you, sir.
So the Treasury designation of currency manipulator is seen by analysts as largely a symbolic move that's going to provide the president and his administration with the political justification to impose more tariffs. But let me start with Linwood. As I understand it, though, there's a clear definition of currency manipulation that has three elements or components. Does China technically meet all three to fall into that category?
Well, I'm not exactly familiar with the three. I mean, I'm familiar with them, but the details, from what I've been reading, no, it does not fit these three categories. China is involved in a trade war, and you know, the U.S. was the first to fire the first shot in that trade war to put up tariffs against Chinese goods. China then has to respond. And one way China can respond is to reduce the value of its currency to get its exports up again. And so if a situation exists in which nothing's going on and one side decides to devalue its currency, you know, that could be considered an offensive act. It could be considered a manipulation. But what China is doing is simply responding in a way in order to keep its economy going at the rate it was going when things were, I guess, on a level playing field with the tariffs that existed. So I'm sure I'm not familiar with the exact three categories, but it does appear to me that China is not manipulating its currency to gain an advantage. It's simply revaluing its currency to get back to where it was before.
Same question to you, Jack. One of the elements is, does China have an account surplus over a six-month period, more exports than imports? Did it add to its foreign exchange reserves over the same period? And then there's also an issue around foreign exchange reserves being more than sufficient. As I understand it, China does not technically meet all three of those elements to be considered a currency manipulator. Your thoughts?
Well, currency manipulation means that you are entering the market, you, the bank, the central bank, entering the market to influence what otherwise free market forces would do to your currency in relationship to other currencies. In other words, you're trying to affect the market influences. You do that by buying or selling your currency in the market, usually for dollars, in order to increase the supply or decrease the supply of your currency in the market, thereby influence the price of your currency, the exchange rate of your currency. Well, China, for the last several years, has been entering the market to stabilize its currency, to keep it from falling due to market forces that are driving the dollar up. If you drive the dollar up, you will drive the yuan, the Chinese currency, down. And market forces, due to Trump policies, have been causing the dollar longer term, medium term to rise, which causes the yuan to fall. Well, China's been entering the market to prevent it from going beyond this band, the upper limit of which is a seven to one,
right?
7-1, yeah. Now, what happened was last week, you know, Trump decided to impose more tariffs against the recommendation of the majority of Mnuchin, Secretary of Treasury, and the trade team. He listened to the neocons again, and I've long been saying that's who he's listening to, who said, no, slap more tariffs on China. Well, he decided to go with his neocons. This wasn't reported in mainstream press that much. You got to go to the international business press to find that out. And, you know, he decided to slap more tariffs. Well, what China did was, okay, we're going to send a warning shot across your bow. We're not going to intervene to keep the yuan from devaluing. We're going to let the market forces devalue it beyond 7-1. And that's exactly what happened. It was a warning shot. Well, you know, China is not manipulating. It's doing everything to prevent the devaluation, but this one time it let it go as a warning shot to Trump. Hey, look, you know, if you want to slap more tariffs, we'll just let the natural forces devalue the yuan to offset your tariffs. Well, this is what, you know.
This is what happened.
This is what happened, right? Now, it's interesting that yesterday, China once again began to enter the market to keep the yuan from devaluing further. In other words, it sent a warning shot to Trump, right? And what does Trump say? Oh, currency manipulator. Well, that means nothing. Currency manipulation charges simply means you can raise tariffs. Well, he's already doing that. You know, he doesn't have to say currency manipulator, but it sounds good politically. But most importantly, I think what it means is that China sent the warning shot across the bow and backed off now. It's intervening to keep it within the ban. And Trump says currency manipulator. I think the two have sort of stepped back here and said, whoa, we better slow down because we saw what Trump's action did to the stock markets and the bond markets last week. In other words, his trade policies, his raising tariffs on China, you know, unrelentingly, is having an effect on business confidence and business investment, which already slowed down dramatically last quarter and is going to slow down more. And we're going to see lagging indicators of employment start to slow down. In other words, Trump is manipulating the yuan and the dollar himself through his trade policy.
There's the talk about this being mainly symbolic.
Yes.
Well, Wall Street doesn't think it's mainly symbolic. Wall Street responded by a 7% decrease in its valuation, one of the largest in a while. And Wall Street is looking at this the charge of devaluation as being more in step with the war that's been going on between China promoted by Trump. And it is not looking at this as a symbolic gesture, even though, you know, the U.S. government has very few things it can do to stop China from valuing, increasing or decreasing the value of its currency. So in that case, you know, the government, U.S. government may have no effect, but bond and stock markets are responding to this as a real thing. It's not simply symbolic to do these kinds of things in a trade war.
Go ahead, Jack.
Well, you know, Wall Street is not responding to the symbolic currency manipulator charge. It's responding to the fact that you have a trade war and you have all these tariffs and it's slowing down the global economy and it's having a negative effect on business confidence and therefore on investment. That's what they're responding to. And they don't see any end to this. We may have a respite here, a sort of a slowdown, let's step back. But this thing is going to continue and it's going to get worse. And Wall Street knows that. It knows that, and it's responding to the slowing of the economy, particularly business investment. It's not responding to this charge of currency manipulator. I mean, look, you know, investors know that China's not manipulating its currency. I mean, watch Bloomberg News today, and they got people coming on, all the experts, and they're all saying, no, it's not a manipulation of the currency. But they are saying that we have a problem here, that Trump trade policy is slowing the global economy and business investment, and that's what we're responding to.
The president tweeted today, Linwood, quote, massive amounts of money from China and other parts of the world is pouring into the United States for reasons of safety, investment, and interest rates. We are in a very strong position. Is that an accurate assessment of reality?
Well, there is significant money, yes, pouring into the U.S. from China, but it's not yuan, it's dollars. You know, no one in the U.S. is using dollars. It's not tender in the U.S. And so to the fact that Chinese nationals and Chinese government to some extent has dollars to invest in the U.S., that's a good thing for those who are wanting to sell things in the U.S., who are wanting to take those investments and to use them. So yuan, the devaluation of the Chinese currency, makes things more expensive in the U.S., and so those investments may not go as far as they went before, but they're still pouring into the dollars. Wall Street likes that. The real estate investors like Trump. They like that. They get foreign money all the time. When I say foreign money, I don't mean yuan. I mean dollars from foreign nationals. So that's not a new thing, and Trump has been taking advantage of that in his own business enterprises.
But, Jack, implicit in that statement from the president, and I could be reading more into this than there is, but in my opinion, implicit in that statement is that this money that's coming in from China into the U.S. is actually having a positive impact on the daily lives of you and I. And to Linwood's point, oh, yeah, they're buying real estate. Oh, they're buying cars. Or, oh, they're buying, they're investing. But those investments, going back to your whole discussion about the financialized economy, that's not translating into manufacturing more things, creating more jobs, raising wages, and people doing better.
Yeah, well, look where the investment is going. And it's true, you've got a flood coming in. Currencies around the world are devaluing faster than the dollar. There's a gap between the dollar and these other currencies. And as the Fed lowers rates, these other central banks are lowering their rates even further, which is depressing their currencies, causing capital flight. In other words, the money is flowing out of these other emerging markets, including China, and it's going into dollars in order to buy treasuries. And that's what's driving down interest rates in the U.S. and driving up the price of treasuries. But the point is, where does that money go after it's converted to dollars? It's going into financial markets. It's going into mergers and acquisitions. It's going into balance sheets, sitting on balance sheets. Corporations are cashing in and sitting on the sidelines. Now, it's not going into real investment. Look at real investment, which is declining. In other words, investment in production expansion and plant and equipment and so forth. That is stagnating. That is falling. So the money coming in is going into financial markets or sitting on the sidelines or buying treasuries, which isn't stimulating the U.S. economy. So it's a big lie by Trump that this money floating in, and this is just one of his ways of spinning a bad situation, is going to boost the U.S. economy. No, it's not. You know, if it is coming in from Asia, there's a problem with money coming in from Asia, buying housing and properties and driving up housing, residential housing prices to unsustainable levels. That is true. Asians like to invest in land and property, and the money is coming in from Asia and China included, and investing in certain markets in the United States and driving up unaffordability, where average Americans, particularly millennials, cannot afford to buy a house anymore. And of course, rising house prices drive up rent prices. So yeah, it's coming into real estate, it's coming into financial markets, stocks and bonds, and it's coming into mergers, and it's sitting on balance sheets.
Dr. Linwood Tawheed, with the money that's coming in, the one thing China's not buying are U.S. agriculture products.
Exactly.
With China officially pulling out of buying U.S. agriculture products, American farmers are losing one of their biggest customers. I think I've got a couple numbers here. China made up $5.6 billion in U.S. farm product exports in 2018. And from September of 27 to May of 2018, soybean exports to China totaled 27.7 million tons. That number has dropped by more than 70% to 7 million tons during the same nine-month period from 2018 and 2019. So, to Trump's point, money's coming in, but it's not being invested in Iowa.
That's correct. And, you know, that horse already left the barn when Trump began to impose his taxes, and the Chinese responded by, his tariffs, and the Chinese responded by putting tariffs on soybeans. Those soybeans became very expensive, and Chinese buyers of soybeans began to look elsewhere, to Brazil and in particular, but to other areas as well. And they already have those contracts. Those contracts are long-term. And so there's very little that any of this will do to get back those soybean markets for American farmers. Those markets are gone.
And Linwood, I've got an issue. You know, the president is trying to bolster the American farmers, the soybean farmers and the pork farmers and the others that are losing because China's cutting back on its investment. I have a problem with my tax dollar going to support a farmer in a fight that Donald Trump started. If this were the result of, you know, natural market forces or, a flood that wiped out the crop and we had to support the farmers, and I'm behind him 1,000%. But Donald Trump picked this fight, so let Donald Trump pay for it.
I would agree with that sentiment. This is a political, obviously a purely political maneuver that he had to engage in so that he wouldn't lose more of his base. Supports to farmers is old news. I mean, it's not a new thing. And so, but what that meant was when this particular crisis occurred because of what the Trump administration did, there were already institutional mechanisms in place that could be expanded to allow this to happen. If there were no price supports in place initially, then Trump would have to go to Congress to have laws passed and so forth to have price support put in place. They were already there, but they were not intended to be used to offset bad political maneuvers by the president in imposing tariffs and starting a trade war. They were there to offset natural weather ups and downs that would create disturbances in products from year to year in order to stabilize them. And if you have a bad year in farming and farmers cannot make a profit, in fact, go into losses and, let's say, lose their seed crop, then they can't invest for the next year. So that's a disaster. And so price supports were intended to tide farmers over in uneven times. But once those mechanisms of supplements and supports for farmers are in place, they can be used for political purposes. And Trump, in response to the Chinese reaction in raising tariffs on soybeans and other farm products that primarily hit the Midwest, where Trump's base is concentrated, Trump used those mechanisms that were already in place to try to shore up the finances of his base so that they would not become too disgruntled. So this is obviously and purely a political maneuver that Trump is taking advantage of the existing governmental infrastructure.
We're running out of time, but there are two other issues I want to touch on quickly that are not trade related, but China says that they're not going to stand idly by if U.S. puts missiles in the Asia-Pacific region. China said today that if the U.S. follows through with the announced plan to place intermediate-range missiles in the Asia-Pacific region, the director of the Foreign Ministry's Arms Control Department, Fu Kong, said China is concerned about the plans to develop and test a land-based intermediate missile range in the region sooner than later. And this all comes, of course, last week, U.S. pulled out of the arms control pact, the INF treaty with Russia. And so now basically all bets are off. And then the other issue, China vowing to crack down on Hong Kong protesters. China said today that they've warned the criminals they claim are behind weeks-long protests in Hong Kong not to play with fire, and vowed to crack down on the organizers, signaling that Beijing has no intention of giving in to their demands. Jack, are those two issues factoring into the trade war? Is the trade war factoring into these two issues, or are these just all what's geopolitical circumstances?
No, of course, they're all related, and it's all part of the neocon-driven foreign policy of the United States right now. As I've argued many times, the neocons are in the driver's seat with regard to the trade deal, and they don't want a negotiation, a settlement, unless China capitulates on technology, next-generation technology, which is military in its content. And you know, threatening and planning to put intermediate missiles closer to China, and what's going on in Hong Kong? I think these things are all related. I mean, Hong Kong, the appearance is not the whole story here. There's something else going on behind the scenes in Hong Kong. We don't know about it yet. I suspect it has something to do with, you know, the U.S. intelligence agency stoking fires over there. But, you know, we'll see eventually. What's behind this? There's a lot of discontent with millennials and young people with the living conditions in Hong Kong. I think that's driving this thing as well. It's not just about, you know, expatriation back to China. There's more to it there. And as far as this, you know, missiles are concerned, well, the U.S. is doing the same thing in Eastern Europe with the Russians. This is all part of the approach by the neocons, which thinks that if you intimidate, you try to intimidate, you're going to prevail over your adversary. But, you know, that doesn't work. Intimidation doesn't work anymore. And this isn't the 1950s. The U.S. global economic military empire is not as strong as it was. And you just can't intimidate your way with sanctions and all the rest and get what you want. But the neocons driving U.S. policy think so. So, I see a linkage between all of this.
Dr. Linwood Tahid, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think Jack is right. I mean, there is a linkage, and I think the point about the neocons driving this is important. You know, Hong Kong is an example of capitalism on steroids. If you've got lots of money in Hong Kong, you can do very well. If you don't, you're going to suffer. Lots of people are suffering, and political discontent is going to come from that. It's interesting that the Chinese, who are have some control over Hong Kong, if they choose to exercise it, is not using this more in a political way to show the differences between a Chinese form of capitalism and a Western form of capitalism in terms of being able to address the issues of the poor and so forth. They're simply wanting to clamp down on the poor and the discontent, as opposed to engaging in some kind of policy that would give hope to the poor and the discontented. But in terms of Trump, you know, the neocons in his administration are forcing him into a position of reneging on the promises that he made to his base. Trump's promises to his base was, you know, not to engage in any new wars unnecessarily, and not to try to expand the, quote, presence of U.S. empire around the globe to be, I guess, more inward-looking than outward-looking. And so you had the neocons who are wanting to look outward in terms of expanding the U.S. empire, and you have Trump's base, to which he promised to reverse that process. And so we find Trump doing things and then having to pull it back because his base gets upset, doing things in terms of trade policy and having to pull it back because Wall Street is upset. It seems to me that we have some significant warring forces going on in the Trump administration, and Trump is just reacting to the last person who
leaves the room.
And then moves back and forth. So there's plenty of instability in this administration, and that's very dangerous.
Gentlemen, I have to stop it there. Thank you so much for your time, Dr. Linwood Tahid, Associate Professor of Economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, Dr. Jack Rasmus, Professor of Economics and Politics at St. Mary's College of California. Thank you both. As always, thank you for your contribution to the Critical Hour. Look forward to having you back.
Thank you.
All right. All right, folks, you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you are listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. So it was reported that Puerto Rico governor resigns as promised, successor sworn in. Puerto Rico Governor Ricardo Rosselló resigned Friday as promised, clearing the way for veteran politician Pedro Pierluisi to be sworn in as his replacement. But I don't think that it's been quite that simple. For insight into these latest developments, we turn to my next guest. She is Associate Professor of Anthropology in the Department of Anthropology and Sociology and Women, Gender, and Sexuality and Critical Theory, Concentration and Community and Global Health at Kalamazoo College, Dr. Adriana Garriga Lopez. Welcome to the Critical Hour.
Thank you for having me.
So Governor Rosselló promised to step down in response to weeks of popular protest over mismanagement and a series of leaked chats in which he and advisors denigrated a range of Puerto Ricans and even verbally desecrating the dead. Because of problems with the qualifications of members of Rosselló's administration in the constitutional line of succession, it was unclear and may still be who can become governor. So a few days ago, people were very happy. They were jubilant over the success of this movement to force Rosselló out of office. Then on Friday, people are now unhappy and confused about who's going to be their next governor. Is that a fair assessment? And if so, explain to us where we are.
Yes, I think that is a fair assessment in terms of the mood, which has shifted from celebratory to anger and disappointment. There is a lot going on, including a Supreme Court case that is being heard, I believe, as we speak here in Puerto Rico, about whether Pierluisi's swearing in as governor was actually constitutional or not. And there's no way to tell just yet how that will be resolved and what it will mean if he is found to have been inconstitutionally or unconstitutionally sworn in. And who would assume the position of governor if he has to be removed? And if he has to be removed, it's possible that it would be Wanda Vázquez, but Wanda Vázquez has said that she does not want the position. And there's some question about her legitimacy, given her own involvement in the Rosselló administration, as well as some of the corruption scandals that rocked the administration, and which was one of the things that detonated the protest that we saw throughout July. So what is happening right now, I think, I mean, there's different fronts of what's happening, right? That's the legal front. On the political front, there's massive fracturing within the pro-statehood party, incredible battles for power within that party, different factions, you know, stabbing each other in the back and doing everything they can to assume control over the political process. And the president of the Senate, Tomás Rivera Chats, is one of those people who's probably the main contender, although there are others, like Jennifer González, who's the resident commissioner in D.C. right now and is widely believed to be the most likely candidate for governor under the pro-statehood party in the next election. So all of the pieces are in movement on that front. And the opposition party, what might be called the opposition party, which is the Populares or the PPD, or the status quo party, which has traded power back and forth with the pro-statehood party since 1952. Basically, they have lost political legitimacy. Their project has lost all political legitimacy over the last 5 years, given that the United States Supreme Court, the United States Executive, and Congress have all expressly declared that Puerto Rico is an unincorporated territory of the United States, and that the so-called free associated state, the ELA, the Estado Libre Asociado,
which is what the current government calls itself. It's not a constitutional status, and therefore Puerto Rico is still under plenary powers from the U.S. government. What that means is that the Puerto Rican Constitution, which is the basis of the, you know, the debate that's going on right now, we're in a constitutional crisis, but the deeper problem is that the Puerto Rican Constitution itself is not premised on the sovereignty of the Puerto Rican people, but rather premised on the plenary powers held by Congress over Puerto Rico based on the territoriality, based on the fact that Puerto Rico is a colony of the United States. And since the early 20th century, the United States has, if you look back in the congressional record, you discover that the justification for holding Puerto Rico as a territory is that the United States believed that the inhabitants of Puerto Rico were nothing but half-breeds, mongrels, and pirates who did not deserve and were not capable of self-government and democracy. So until the political process can deal, can attend to, can change that fundamental problematic, I don't think that we're going to see a real resolution of Puerto Rico's political woes. Now, that's on a very large scale, right? And we can also talk, if you want me to talk, I can also talk about the community level dynamics, right? The interpersonal dynamics that are taking place right now in Puerto Rico.
Please do. Yeah, that's really what I would like to get. And I know, based upon your background, that's near and dear to your heart.
Yes, that's indeed. And there's a lot to say there, too. There's a lot of, Facebook, Puerto Rican Facebook today is like endless battles.
Oh, wait a minute. Before you do that, let me ask one question. You mentioned the Supreme Court case that's being heard right now. Is that the case that's been brought by San Juan Mayor Carmen Yulín Cruz, or is her case separate from the case that you're referring to?
That's a separate case. The case that is being heard today is the one that was filed by the president of the Senate, Tomás Rivera Schatz. I'm not sure what's happened with Mayor Yulín Cruz's case. The standing of her case was a little more questionable, and so I'm not sure that has proceeded.
Okay.
So the one that they agreed to see was the one that was filed by the president of the Senate.
Okay. Now, with my having interrupted you, please forgive me and proceed.
No problem. I mean, like I said, there's so much to say here. I think we're going to be talking about these developments for a long time to come. So there's a lot of debate within the independentista groups, the groups that are pro-independence, leftist groups, feminist groups, queer groups, community groups, all kinds of activist groups, which have been in resistance not only to U.S. colonialism, but more specifically to the PROMESA legislation and the fiscal control board that it created, and which has imposed austerity measures in Puerto Rico that have decimated the education sector, the healthcare sector, and basically all public services in Puerto Rico, in an effort to sell off as much public holdings in order to pay off the debt. So these groups, these community groups, have been organizing on all these different fronts, right, including environmental fronts against the AES coal company that has been dumping toxic coal ash in communities. There's been a lot of power that has been gained by local feminist and queer groups who were at the forefront of these protests and that we saw during July, which were so powerful and which were successful. We were successful in removing the governor, which was a historic feat. And so we all know, we're all aware now of our own power and the things that we're capable of achieving and accomplishing when we are all on the same side, right? So there's this complicated dynamic where the protest and our success in removing the governor created now this new sense of power and possibility, while at the same time the institutions, legal and political institutions, as well as political parties and, you know, protagonists, people who want to be protagonists, have immediately now begun to insert themselves and try to dominate the public discourse and try to determine the outcome of these events. But the reality is that the political parties have no legitimacy anymore among the people. And so we're in a situation of a great fragility. It is not clear yet what is going to happen. But the beautiful thing that has happened is that communities have continued to self-organize, just like they did after Hurricane Maria. Just yesterday, I was at a protest where people were handing out free plates of food, the same people that were doing the comedores sociales, the free food mutual aid societies after Maria. Those folks were at the protest yesterday. There's still this incredible network of mutual aid that grew out of the experiences of Maria after Hurricane Maria. And so people are empowered to self-organize. And so every day we see more and more communities calling for people's assemblies. And every day there is at least one town that is having a people's assembly, which just means people showing up to the town square. In every town in Puerto Rico, there's a town square because they're all built after the Spanish style.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a central plaza. So everybody's gathering in the plaza and talking about what they need and what they're not getting and what they want for the future. And I think that that's a very welcome development. That's a very positive development, that we're actually seeing people coming together, dialoguing, and, you know, engaging with each other despite differences, and really trying to identify items that we can build consensus on to move forward. But there is here an inevitable confrontation that we're heading towards between these self-organized, autonomous, you know, bottom-up movements of people's movements and these basically colonial institutional powers, including the pro-independence party, which has itself been part of the colonial, you know, legal, political establishment. So we're headed towards this confrontation. And unfortunately, I think the people's movements and the community groups, we're in a weaker position because obviously they hold power, they hold political power. And there's no model, there's no historically, politically in the world, there's no structure, there's no, you know, a structure for autonomous government. So it's very difficult to elaborate a political proposal or a political program out of protests which were self-organized. There was no one person calling for these protests. It wasn't Bad Bunny. It wasn't Residente. It wasn't one group.
These are truly organic.
These are just people being so angry,
right,
and so fed up that they just hit the streets.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw all kinds of people in the streets. I saw very elderly people. I saw babies. I saw, you know, Black Puerto Ricans. I saw women. I saw gender nonconforming people, trans people. It's been wonderful to see that trans people at the leadership of these movements and these demonstrations. We still see that. So they'll go to a protest and you're going to see trans people, queer people, gender nonconforming people, feminists, Black Puerto Ricans taking leadership in these protests. And so we're in this very complicated and contradictory moment where it's the most beautiful, optimistic, revolutionary moment that we have lived in 70 years in Puerto Rico since the nationalist uprisings of the early 20th century under the leadership of Pedro Albizu Campos, which were certainly not feminist. And at the same time, you know, we're in Trump. We're in the Trump era.
Right. It's a
and
mess.
We know everything is completely mad, right?
Right.
And we know, I think the thing is, there's a bit of fear that is starting to creep in because we are aware that the backlash is coming. Right?
Right.
The leftist groups, the feminist groups, the independence groups. We know that the federal government has persecuted and criminalized activists in Puerto Rico throughout the 120 years of our colonial subjection to the United States. And we already heard reports of one compañero who is stuck in an airport and not being allowed to travel to Puerto Rico because of his political activities, is being held in an airport. So we know that there's that backlash is coming. We know that there's going to be political persecution against people. And I think there is a bit of fear about that.
The analogy I would draw here is it's almost like chasing a bear and then cornering it. Hey, great, we caught the bear. Now what do we do with it? Because the backlash could be horrific. Wow.
That's right. That's where we are. But, you know, I think you have to remember, I don't know if you know, but the one chant that permeated throughout all the protests and that really came to define the protest during July is Somos más y no tenemos miedo. We are more and we're not afraid,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So now's the time when we get to really live that, right? We get to really continue to work, do the work that we need to do in our communities, continue to stand in solidarity with each other. Yes, we're going to debate. Yes, we're going to disagree. Yes, we're going to have different opinions. But we need to continue building solidarity and a sense of purpose and a sense of capacity and a sense of self-worth and validation among Puerto Ricans so that we can decide how we're going to confront that bear, how we're going to, I don't want to kill the bear. I'm an animal lover, so I hate to say that. But I think your metaphor is apt, right?
I'm sorry to cut you off, but I got to get out and let me close with this. With Puerto Rico technically being constitutionally still being a colonial subject, we know that the colonial power does not like protest. We know the colonial power does not like revolt, and the colonial power will not relinquish power easily. As Frederick Douglass said, power yields nothing without demand. It never has, and it never will. So the next page in the chapter has yet to be written, but I'm glad to hear you calling for cohesiveness and solidarity within the people of Puerto Rico as they face the colonial power.
Well, you have to understand that we have a long tradition of rebellion from the slave rebellion and the Taino rebellions against the Spanish in Puerto Rico. We see ourselves as being part of that line. That's our heritage. And it's amazing how fast, in 2 weeks, with relentless protests, with being present, we were able to remove the government. That's how scared of us they are. That's how powerful we really are. So just like our ancestors fought the slave masters and fought the conquistadores, I'm sure that the people of Puerto Rico will continue to rise up and demand justice and demand freedom for our people.
Dr. Adriana Garriga Lopez, thank you so much for your time. Look forward to having you back. We'll be calling on you quite often.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thank you. All right, folks, you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Trump signs executive order freezing Venezuelan assets, ramping up pressure on President Nicolas Maduro. President Trump, he issued an executive order late yesterday, placing a full economic embargo on the Venezuelan government of President Nicolas Maduro and his administration. He warned Russia and China that if they continue to support Maduro, they may never get back their billions of dollars in loans and investments in Venezuela. This drumbeat continues. For insight and analysis into this, we turn to my next guest. He's an organizer in Pan-African Community Action, the events coordinator at the Institute for Policy Studies, and radio producer and host of Voices with Vision on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., Brother Netfa Freeman. Welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thank you, Brother Wilmer. I got to put in there Black Alliance for Peace because I think that's the more relevant affiliation.
No, I'm sorry. I omitted that. Please, please forgive me. No slight intended. Because we just had Brother Ajamu Baraka on yesterday. So the Black Alliance for Peace is well strong and always articulated on this program. So this latest move, I've been saying for quite a while, even though there hasn't been a whole lot in the media, that the settler colonial power was not going to go away quietly, was not going to go quietly into the night. And it seems as though the president just won't let this go.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and I tend to, a lot of people focus on Trump. I tend to think it's a lot of these hawkish people around him
that are more
like setting this agenda, you know, but it really doesn't matter. It's all a system. And I think that's something we have to understand. And what we really, in terms of even stating the Black Alliance for Peace position, and I think it's something we got to reiterate so people get it, that the United States really has, it's never been bestowed with some moral authority to be able to impose sanctions or anything supposedly for some benevolent reason, supposedly because they're concerned about human rights in the country or, you know, these kind of things, because that's not what, you know, its disposition has been to murder and maim and kill and countries around the world. So right now, I think what we're seeing, and I don't know if you know, I guess you asked me because I just came back from Venezuela, just came back last Friday. And we actually even met with the president, President Nicolas Maduro. I was there as part of the Embassy Protection Collective, a delegation of the Embassy Protection Collective, just a small delegation of those people went. And we were able to sit with Maduro. And he mentioned something very interesting that I think we should examine. And it's the resurrection or maybe a revival, should we say, of the Monroe Doctrine, which is something they actually state openly. And also an anti-communism or an anti-socialism. And I think that we, and one of the things, points that we were trying to make when we were there, part of our solidarity with that is that we also have this same enemy. So what we're seeing is this white supremacist, and you know, I'm sure Brother Jammu mentioned it well, the intersection or the monster of white supremacist, pan-European white supremacist capitalist patriarchy system, you know, kind of intensifying and trying to level its influence all over the world, domination. But the people in Venezuela are remarkable. And so one of the more impressive things about our trip was not really so much meeting, you know, something like meeting with the president, which was really cool, but it was actually being able to see the people's projects on the ground, and they are looking at this with such resolve and with the attitude of wanting to having to overcome the sanctions and these type of things. In like the New York Times article that they mentioned, when they talk about this full total economic sanctions on Venezuela, they mention something about the people are demonstrating against the sanctions or something like that, but they also say they're demonstrating against the Maduro government, the repression of them. This is in the New York Times article. And that's why people need to, we need to be able to go there to eyewitness. Ain't nothing like that happening. It's just not happening. You know, that is, there, people are not talking about that. In fact, we met with a lot of people, and a lot of the Venezuelan people were expressing such gratitude of the people that protected the embassy. And for them, it wasn't about protecting some building or anything,
right,
but it was about the people in the U.S. defending their right to self-determination. And they asserted that over and over again. People really moved by that. And, I mean, that was a lot of the main thing that we, wherever we went. And so what we see here, and people have reiterated themselves all the time, their right to have their own president, and Nicolas Maduro was elected, whether they agree with him or not, and the United States doesn't have a right to impose its will on it. We were also there. We were part of the – we participated in the Sao Paulo Forum, which is a forum of leftist Latin American countries, you know, government officials and whatnot, and activist movements that happen there. Well, actually, the Sao Paulo Forum is mostly activist, non-governmental. But just before that happened, when we came, the non-aligned meeting, which is mostly governments, was happening in Venezuela. Both these things took place in Venezuela. And so what we're seeing, and which may elude a lot of the people in the United States, that there are people coming together against the insistence of U.S. and pretty much European and U.S. Hegemony. And so people are trying to work and deal with that. The non-aligned movement, which was like before, like, you know, when it first started, was acknowledged that they have different ideological, you know, ideologies and whatnot. They might not all be socialists or whatever, but they all agree that they have to be able to realize a multipolar world and do something to check these hegemonic forces in imperialism. And then on the ground with the Sao Paulo Forum, we actually had the honor and privilege to be. It was a lot of things going on in the Sao Paulo Forum, but one that was most inspirational and moving to me was a forum of Latin American or Latino Afro, what they call it, Afro Latino descendants, African descendants of in Latin America, which actually did also include some people from Africa. So Senegal, Benin was there, and them coming together, making some resolutions that asserted rights and asserted their commitment to anti-imperialism, anti-neoliberalism, and Pan-African, revolutionary Pan-African agenda. It was quite some time there, and that kind of stuff, you know, escapes our people here a lot.
Absolutely. It was interesting to me that President Trump sent a letter to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who's a Democrat, last night, and he said that the freezing of the assets of Maduro was necessary, quote, in light of the continued usurpation of power by the illegitimate Nicolas Maduro regime, as well as the regime's human rights abuses, arbitrary arrests and detention of Venezuelan citizens, curtailment of free press, and ongoing attempts to undermine Guaido. Now, a couple of things here. One, it's not surprising, but I think people need to understand, I haven't heard a thing from Nancy Pelosi on this issue, refuting what Trump has said. And people need to understand, as though they think there are these huge, vast differences between Democrats and Republicans, particularly when it comes to foreign policy, it's all about the American empire, and the political differences dissolve quickly and fall by the wayside. Also, in his talking about ongoing attempts to undermine Guaido, well, Maduro is the democratically elected president of the country. So, you know, he's sovereign in that position. So as sovereign, he can, for all intents and purposes, do what he wants to do within the confines of the Venezuelan Constitution. So by calling the government illegitimate, again, democratically elected, human rights abuses, I think that's just thrown in for giggles. Arbitrary arrest and detention of Venezuelan citizens. Well, it's up to the government of Venezuela to determine under their laws who can be arrested and for what. Curtailment of the free press. Donald Trump actually talking to somebody about curtailment of the free press. But again, Nancy Pelosi didn't say boo to this.
No, I think that's where we can see the when it comes to both the Democrats and the Republicans, that they're very much aligned when it comes to foreign policy, particularly foreign policy, but even a lot of things really domestically. But when it comes to foreign policy, there's no disagreement there. And that's why you see in a lot of times the posturing, which looks as if they're trying to be opposed Trump, results in kind of silence when it comes to certain foreign policy issues, because they don't want to talk about those kind of things, you know. And so even when they do, it's like it'll be something like, oh, well, we don't believe this is the way to do it or something like that, as opposed to this should not even be done. And when you go to the issue of human rights there, you know, I thought it was very impressive, this type of commune projects, people's projects that the people have there, where people are actually being supported by the government, unlike in the United States, where people are struggling with things like housing and being displaced by gentrification and don't have health care and, you know, closing of schools and all that. The people are being empowered and actually provided resources by the government and in consistency with the Constitution to help them build their own communities.
And they're being fed. They're being fed by the government.
And they're being fed. Mm-hmm. So, but also being empowered to create projects that will help them feed themselves. Like we went to communities where they actually, and we saw a documentary, went to the community, then saw a documentary about the community while we were there. They were seeing it for the first time too, where they actually built these cement apartment complexes, water, all that kind of stuff. They had a community bakery in there, a clinic, daycare center, all this in one apartment. And then we visited a few of them, so it wasn't just one, and all of them did this, you know, they had maybe slightly different sort of things. Another one had a radio station in it, and they describe how they're living as communes. These are commune projects that are supported by the Bolivarian revolution and their Bolivarian process, as they refer to it. And so they always uphold the government and how this is a legacy of Chavez and how Maduro is continuing that legacy and how they are adamantly about resistance by any, you know, outside forces to undermine it. This is what they say that they're defending. So when they start talking about their, you know, when the U.S. starts talking about like they're doing things on behalf of the Venezuelan people are not, that's just not how they look at it. So, and these are human rights. I mean, it makes no sense. It doesn't even really fly in the face of common sense to think if there was some government or some, you know, some dictators in power that were really repressing senselessly their people, they would also help the people provide for these human needs in such a democratic and special, I guess, special way, some creative way.
And to that point, as we wrap this up, we've talked about this a number of times, but over history with the revolution through the government of Hugo Chavez, the millions of people that have been lifted out of poverty and whose lives, quality of life have been improved because of this so-called communism, this so-called socialism, that if it took over the world would cease to, well, might not be a bad idea if it ceased to exist as we know it. But I think you get my point. Brother Netfa Freeman with the Black Alliance for Peace. He's also with the Institute for Policy Studies and producer and host of Voices with Vision on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C. Netfa, as always, thanks for your time. Greatly appreciate your contribution to the Critical Hour.
Thank you, brother.
Thank you, man. All right, folks, you have been listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.